This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Before I launch into the presentation, I would like to thank many people who were involved in this project. Mosaic Ocean emerged in the context of the Getty-funded PSD project, Oceanographic Art and Science, headed by PIs Lisa Cartwright and Nan Renner. And I thank them for their vision that brought together scientists, humanities scholars, and artists to explore this theme in an interdisciplinary fashion. Our team, consisting of Dr. Melody Zhu, Dr. Jules Jaffe, and myself, embarked on a long collaboration, at first mostly on Zoom because it was summer 2020, that culminated in a book chapter exploring the concept of Mosaic Ocean. And later it culminated in the exhibit that is here at Birch Aquarium. The Jaffe Lab generously shared many folders of images taken by their underwater cameras at the SIO Pier during 2022. The collage that I created for this exhibit consists of selections from hundreds of these amazing images. And the 3D video that plays inside the walls of the exhibit inside here were also created by the Jaffe team. In addition, I thank the entire Birch Aquarium design and fabrication team. Without their special help, this exhibition wouldn't exist. They brought it to fruition. Last, I want to say that my presentation will not address these amazing images or details because it is historical. It is based on years of archival research on the history of Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and in particular, the work of Dr. Easter Ellen Cupp. So without further ado, this is the exhibit that the Birch team helped to bring about inside, if you have a chance to see it. So without further ado, I will present pages from the book of the Unknown Explorer. All right. May 26, 1939. Dear Dr. Cupp, I was referred to you by Dr. Dennis Llewellyn Fox, who I had the privilege of meeting last week at an Explorers Club gathering. We had a splendid conversation about his work investigating color in the animal world. Dr. Fox is visiting New York on account of his recent Rockefeller Fellowship and is using this occasion to raise awareness about the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, or SIO for short. He recounted that recently this institution, entirely devoted to marine research, published a report outlining plans to take advantage of their excellent staff engaged in diverse oceanographic research and their state-of-the-art laboratories to engage with the study of large-scale oceanographic problems requiring systematic data from the sea. Dr. Fox showed me pictures taken by you of the 104-foot schooner E.W. Scripps that the institution acquired last year. He explained how this new vessel will facilitate SIO's explorations at sea and expand its programs. It was in the context of this conversation that he mentioned your work with diatoms, and now I've arrived at the reason for my letter. But first, let me introduce myself. My name is Anna Schwartz. I was born 1920 in Budapest, Hungary. When I turned 12, I received a box camera for my birthday. My first photograph was published in a newspaper. And by age 15, I had developed an obsession with phenomena of light, shadow, and transparency. I'm also an avid naturalist, and I have always admired women scientists as well as adventurers such as Maria Sibylla Marianne, who was the first person to observe and document the metamorphosis of butterflies, and who voyaged from Amsterdam to Suriname in 1699 to search for exotic caterpillars. Another hero of mine is Jeanne Barrée, who was the first woman known to circumnavigate the globe in 1776, disguised as a male valet and botanical assistant to Philibert Commerson, physician and royal naturalist on Louis-Antoine de Bougainville's voyage around the earth. Incidentally, it was most likely Jeanne, disguised as Jean, who, when in Brazil, discovered my favorite plant that was later named after Captain Bougainville. In the summer of 1935, I was vacationing and taking pictures in the Hungarian countryside when I made the most unexpected acquaintance. Peter Markham Scott traveled to Hungary that summer to bring new inhabitants to the lighthouse on the Wash, where he has recently moved and where he lives surrounded by wildfowl that he has collected from around the world. Indeed, he returned from Hungary with 15 live geese in crates. He told me about his famous parents, the explorer Robert Falcon Scott, whom I'm sure you've heard about. However, you may not know that his wife, Kathleen, is an accomplished sculptor. In 1910, Kathleen Scott had accompanied her husband to New Zealand, where he set sail to Antarctica. And after he perished in 1912, she secured the commission to create the commemorative statue erected in London and later in Christchurch. Before I digress too much, what I really need to tell you is that Peter Scott invited me to visit him in England, and to entice me, he told me about the remarkable scientific reports of the HMS Challenger. I'm sure you're already familiar with this first global marine expedition organized and funded by the British Royal Society with the purpose to examine the deep sea floor and answer comprehensive questions about the ocean environment. Based on Peter's account, I determined that I had to see the Challenger manuscripts firsthand, and I traveled to London in 1937. I saw disappointingly little of Peter, but on the other hand, I had ample time to pore over the pages of the Challenger report. And this is how I first discovered the microorganisms that have come to enthrall me. The enchanting shapes of diatoms, as well as their adaptation to such varied environments, fascinate me. And I understand that while individually minute, their collective contribution is colossal in the life of the oceans. I was similarly gripped by the sea angel and the sea butterfly. The Limacina halicina, or sea butterfly, is a shelled planktonic snail that is abundant in the southern oceans, together with its predator, the Cleona antarctica, or sea angel. The Limacina halicina is the sole food source of the Cleona antarctica, and thus their existence is intricately linked. The symbiosis of these organisms, as well as their transparency, captivate me, and I want to be the first one to photograph the light coming through their bodies and shells. This is why I've crossed the ocean, to visit my cousin, Evelyn Schwartz, who was born and raised in New York. Evelyn is involved in a burgeoning relationship with Wilhelm von Stefansson, the famous and controversial polar explorer. Currently, Stefansson is the president of the Explorers Club, and he holds some of the club meetings at Evelyn's favorite haunt, Romany Marie's Restaurant in Greenwich Village. This is where I met Dr. Fox last week. I was thrilled to learn from him about a woman scientist who is studying some of the exact organisms that captivate me. I've so many questions that I don't know where to start. Are you familiar with the book, The Depths of the Ocean by John Murray and Johan Hjort? In it, they say that oceanography is a patiently put together mosaic representation of the discoveries made from time to time by sinking instruments and appliances into the deep and bringing to the surface material for examination and study. As someone who's involved in sampling, I would love to know what you think. Please tell me everything about how you collect specimens, what you see under the microscope, and how you represent what you see. I hope you forgive the length of this letter, as well as the multitude of inquiries. Sincerely, Anna Schwartz. August 20, 1939. Dear Anna, thank you for your letter and my sincere apologies for the delay. I have been very busy with my book and I wanted to respond thoughtfully to your inquiries. Since you so graciously recounted elements of your life, I will share some of my history. I was born in Neola, Iowa on Easter Day, March 30, 1904. My father, Joseph, was a contractor, and we moved to Whittier, California in 1910 when I was six. I attended Whittier College, where I received my bachelor's degree in 1926, followed by a master's degree in zoology from the University of California, Berkeley, in 1928. That same year, I moved to La Jolla to begin my doctoral research and rented one of the staff cottages on campus together with my longtime friend, Dorothy Rosenberry. Right away, I began assisting my doctoral advisor, Winfried Emery Allen, with his plankton research. I published several papers on the subject, and in 1934, I received my PhD in biological oceanography. Since then, I have worked as an associate oceanographer and instructor at SIO, where I'm the only woman scientist. The other women work as secretaries and librarians. Currently, I'm completing a comprehensive book on the marine plankton diatoms of the West Coast of America. Returning to your letter, I was excited to hear about your acquaintance with Peter Scott. While I was very young, in 1912, I've always been fascinated by polar exploration. I had the pleasure of visiting the South Pole ship of Admiral Byrd just a few years ago. On a much smaller scale, our ship, the E.W. Scripps, that Dr. Fox described to you, facilitates exploration far beyond our immediate coast, which is thrilling. Yet, some of our most valuable investigations take place close to home. The Scripps Institution has a pier that was completed in 1916, and Dr. Allen has been collecting samples there for about 20 years. I guess when we think of exploring the vast ocean, the metaphor of mosaic makes sense. But it occurred to me that we can only perceive and comprehend mosaics from the proper perspective. When viewing individual building blocks in isolation, the image falls apart. This reminds me of Dr. Ritter's words when Scripps Institution for Biological Research was inaugurated in 1916. Woven through his speech titled, "What the Scripps Institution is Trying to Do," is a consistent plea for a holistic understanding of the web of existence. He identifies with Alexander von Humboldt, who described the intellectual and emotional impact of nature on humans as equally significant, and he quotes Humboldt, who stated that this impact arises from a presentiment of the order and harmony pervading the whole universe, as also seen in the never-failing unity within the infinite variety of nature. Dr. Ritter warns against the limitations of isolated laboratory science and analysis, making a case for synthesis and the burgeoning field of ecology. He urges scientists in this nascent institution to pursue an enlarged and ideal science lived chiefly outside of and beyond the narrow walls of laboratory and library and museum and lecture room. He adds that the institution, as well as science at large, must admit to its limiting conditions. And in order to live healthily and grow strongly, it must live in both the small here and the vast yonder. My focus has been mostly in the small here. I sit in the laboratory most of the time and analyze the collected specimens from the vast yonder. My forte is close and precise observation, although I also help with the collection. I keep notebooks with copious records and of each hall, and we adhere to strict methods that standardize measurements and documentation as well. However, ultimately, how we observe and record the natural conditions is up to the power of our senses and the adequacy of our words. The process of monitoring the peer population reminds me of film frames that unfold in time rather than a mosaic that unfolds in space. Dr. Allen is working on articles that cover 20 years of research where he grapples with the complexity of measuring, understanding, and representing natural phenomena with so many variables involved. We attempt to visualize our finding with charts that incorporate several dimensions. They're circular, divided into units of time. The circles emanating from the center represent ever larger numbers of organisms as they expand outward, and the different kinds of lines that circle around the chart depict different locations. One chart represents the 20-year average catches of armored dinoflagellates at two locations, La Jolla Pier and Port Huanemi, showing an overall trend toward higher abundance of these organisms in the summer. In another chart, we depict the 20-year averages of one single organism to illustrate that its peak abundance occurs at slightly different times at the two different locations measured. In a third chart, we have divided the circle into 20 slots to show the yearly fluctuation of a single organism over 20 years at both locations between 1920 and 1939. I realize that this letter is growing lengthy, and I'm afraid I've bored you with the details. Before I close, I wanted to tell you that the general consensus is that with organisms as delicate and tiny as diatoms, line drawings provide better representation than photographs. Although for my book, I'm working with both. My secret passion is photography, and I can't wait to ask you about this craft in the future. But I'd better get this off before more days pass and you think I'm ignoring your communication. I'm enclosing a few copies of my drawings as well as some charts and photographs. Sincerely, Easter Cup, November 7, 1939. Dear Easter, I was so happy to receive your package with all the exciting materials. You inspired me to explore new ways to work with line and light, or I should say point and light. I've taken some of your drawings and redrew them with pinpricks. On one side, these pricks appear as tiny holes that add up to lines, while on the other side, they raise the paper, creating minuscule hills that catch the light quite sculpturally. I'm sending some initial photos here. I took the liberty to apply the same process to one of your photographs of Dorothy, the one where she looks into that handheld mirror. I don't know that it works as well for a shaded photograph as it does for the line drawings, but I got unexpected effect when I peeled back the transparency. The raised surface of the transparency looks like so many tiny water bubbles. creating the image. I also made a collage dedicated to you. It is called Self-Portrait with Diatoms. I was inspired to play with pictures in this way after one of Peter Scott's friends, Emma, introduced me to the tradition of album making that thrived in 19th century England. And I realized that women of the Victorian era had effectively invented the photo collage. These albums were self-representations made for an audience of friends and family. They were often displayed in the parlor so people could leaf through them, while sometimes a more intimate version was reserved for a closer circle. My collage is decidedly less colorful, but I think you will understand the inspiration later. I just hope you like it. My dear friend, I'm afraid I will have to end this letter abruptly, as the most unbelievable events have unfolded recently. At the last Explorers Club meeting, I sat next to Ruth Hampton, who oversees the recruitment for Admiral Byrd's third Antarctic expedition. The man lined up for the job of recording scientific data through photography and typing fell ill, and the expedition needs someone immediately. I received high recommendation from Stephenson, and miraculously, I got the job. It's not going to be easy, as I must disguise myself as a man. We are sailing in a few days. Wish me good luck, and I wish you the same. Sincerely, Anna Schwartz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. That was wonderful. And it's very hard to follow science with art because I really enjoy art as well. And I hope I can keep your guys' attention as well as I feel Judith kept mine. I'm here to walk you through some history as well, not just the present day. And I want to thank you all for being here. And I'm going to take you down a walk. On a walk down the pier, and to learn about more about the history and the research that's been conducted over the last 100 years. I'll be highlighting the women who have contributed to the 70 plus years of this plankton research and observations that have been collected. And I just wanted to share a picture of three generations that just recently went out when Karina was in town. A year ago. She's been back, but this was last year. Anyways, my interest in plankton is not about all the great things that they do, you know, because they're responsible for shaping our atmosphere, our climate, and they provide half the oxygen we breathe, or more than that, potentially, and they are the base of the marine food web. But the thing that I find most interesting about them is that they fit in a group. Some of them, a small number of them, fit into a group called harmful algal blooms, or harmful algae, and into that group, they can form harmful algal blooms. This means that some of them can produce toxins. If you look on the bottom left here, you'll see that those are toxin-producing algae that are found here in California, our main three producers, as we call it. And then the organisms on the right are our bloom producers. I like to break HABs up into two groups. I think it helps better understand that they don't all do the same thing, and they can. And there's many different things. They're kind of, if you want to think about it, the villains of the plankton world. So they can potentially cause harm to humans, marine life, by producing these toxins, or by depleting the oxygen. Having a bloom so large that they deplete the oxygen, and they can even disrupt food webs. Another important part about them is they can impact marine resources and the economy by hitting large aquaculture, and I'll share a little bit more about this, but this is really the interest that I have. My work here has also been working with Mike Latz on the bioluminescent bays of Puerto Rico and St. Croix. I've helped him and NGOs develop monitoring programs to better protect these unique resources. And then one of the things that I work on a lot is the Shore Stations program, which is both a historical program that I'll tell you about in a minute, and then also the new technology of the automated program. And there's what the sensors look like underwater, a description or a picture of that. And then I also help with various field projects. I'm a lead on different a trip to Antarctica, and then most recently I'm helping with some dye dispersion projects. I help to do the calibration and help with the instrumentation and figuring out all of that, because it still fluoresces. And then lastly, I've been a volunteer here at the aquarium for the whole time that I've been at Scripps, so more than 25 years. And I'm awful and I don't report my hours, but I still get in the doors somehow. All right, so I really wanted to highlight the women, the many women who have contributed to this research and have really helped keep the observations going for over 70 years. And the top row of these are those that have led before me. Lillian Busa, the woman with the black shirt, is now in Germany, back in Germany, and the head of the German EPA there. Amazing woman, and she's the one that taught me phytoplankton, taxonomy, and started to teach me all of the details, along with Elizabeth Benrick. But Elizabeth Benrick isn't pictured here because she does more offshore work and not peer-based work. The other folks that are pictured here are students and staff that have worked with me throughout the 20 years that I've worked with this program, and it's been really amazing. I've underlined the taxonomists that have actually counted the samples over time, just to narrow the number of people that have worked on it to show that it is a smaller number. However, the daily collection, or not daily, for these samples we collect once or twice per week, and that's really critical as well, the collection of these samples. And if anybody's interested, I have an archive, so keep that in mind. All right, and Judith, you did an amazing job at describing the early days at Scripps, but I wasn't sure how much of that was gonna be in here, so I just wanted to share a little bit more. So this is actually what the pier looked like when it was finished. A lot of people think that the wooden pier is the actual pier when it was finished, and it's not. That's the structure that they put in place to be able to start putting the concrete pilings in. I just want to make sure everyone's really clear on that. And this was finished in 1916 and allowed for researchers to get out and sample and start collecting these observations. And one of the very first observations that they started collecting are the basic parameters, temperature and salinity of the ocean. And this is what makes up the Shore Station program. It's a historical program that collects data at 10 sites along the coast, this being the oldest one, and it's still ongoing. These early days were also guided toward discovery and cataloging of new species and inventing the scientific methods and the instrumentations to conduct this research. And this is still, even though it seems like something of early days, this is still a critical mission of what we do now in present-day research. We try to still find new species, discover new things about them, and develop the instruments to better study them. Alan, shown here with his famous toilet bowl, he has what's called a volumetric tank, which looks like he used a toilet tank. Maybe partly why he wasn't quite enamored very much here at Scripps. He's John McGowan also always referred to him as being in his Sunday golf outfit. That's not just a funny outfit that he had on. He sampled every single day of the week. And so he would come on Sundays and wear his golf outfit to sample. And Roger Revell, shown here with the Allen Plankton bottle. So that bottle as well looks a lot better, was used to collect water samples at depth. So also, again, a new apparatus that had to be created and made in order to collect and do the research they were interested in. And then Easter Cupp here on the bottom, she started in 1928 and was Allen's first graduate student. And as Judith did a great introduction to her work and showing you more of that that I won't have time for, you know, she was brought in specifically to help with a taxonomic identification and to help organize and put this together because it was a very difficult process, and it is a difficult process. So instead of going through a lot of the what was discovered, I want to share some highlights. One thing that I found really interesting in going through a lot of Allen's papers and his work is that, and he wrote many of them, and he was very wordy, as you could say. And he made many inventions as well. He had papers on those. And his 20-year time series really speaks for itself. And but one of my favorite quotes from him was, "To those who may have thought of conditions in the ocean as being so nearly uniform that the routine of life must be rather monotonous, it may seem somewhat shocking to know that our records show no 2 years alike in the 20, no 2 months alike, and no 2 weeks alike. Continual change is the order of nature." And this is actually what made a lot of the early data very complex for them to understand and to analyze. And still, to someone like myself that doesn't do a lot of statistics and math, can be very difficult as well. And I rely on other people to help me with that. Even Cupp stated that there were too many factors that must be considered, along with the temperature, to make the drawing of conclusions a simple matter, because they were always different. And what I wanted to show you with this satellite image here is the, this is of chlorophyll concentration along the coast. The black dots represent the Calcoffee grid, which if many of you, which you seem like you're well-known Scripps people, you know the Calcoffee grid, which is multiple sampling points along out to 500 kilometers. But you can see the chlorophyll concentration changes quite abruptly as you move away from the coast and turns to lighter color, or the darker colors there. And so that productivity is very much limited to the near shore. And Allen noticed that right away, that it was within 50 miles, he said. And this is just some research we did in 2009 showing that using that Calcoffee grid along with the pier and mean chlorophyll concentration, you can see that decreasing as you move further offshore. And he almost got it right, exactly 50 kilometers. And I might have said miles. I apologize for that. And then I was hoping to share more with you about the current data. Like I said, I've been here quite a while collecting these. It's been a tedious process, not only to keep the data sets together, but then combine them all. And I have spent about 2 weeks intensely doing this so I could finally finalize this data set. And I have done that. So I have only been able to start a little bit of an analysis with our data from 2008 to 2024, which is shown in this blue square here. The diatoms are shown in the top, and I apologize that you can't read the bottom. Years, maybe you can, the people on the front row, and dinoflagellate is shown on the bottom. Where Allen's data, all of it is shown in yellow, and that's the 1917 all the way to 1939. And part of what makes this difficult is not all the years are comparable, because he was changing the methods that he was using and trying to better understand how to compare, you know, how to collect these data correctly and how to adequately sample both diatoms and dinoflagellates, which it took them until 1930 really to have comparable methods to what we are doing now. And then the samples that are in white are ones that were collected through the John McGowan program, and Lillian Busa went back and counted those. And the main takeaways from this are mostly what they talked about, that that change is highly variable year to year. If you look at the figure on the right, I have the dates going slightly opposite, where the older is on the top and the more recent samples are on the bottom. And what it's showing is the blue is whenever the community is a diatom community, and the red is whenever it's a dinoflagellate. And I have red because of the red tides. And as Judith showed in her, those original plots, which was perfect, they found that the dinoflagellates were really occurring starting in May and then would recur later in fall. But more recently, what we found is that they can occur in any year or any month within the year. And there seems to be more year-to-year variability than there is a seasonality. We seem to have lost that seasonality. And that's something I'm really interested in understanding a lot more about why that would be. And I always think of it as the extremes that are occurring. So just to show a few more figures about how we're trying to put these data sets together. The Allen's early data and Cupp's early data of Lingulidinium polyhedra, there are very few samples of those, that because they were collected from the 1919 to basically 30 nine, so you would only have seen two blooms. But this representation that Mike Latz put together using all of the research articles that he could find and reports shows all of the years that we've seen blooms since 2020. This was a presentation that he put together for that, for the large-scale bloom that happened in 2020. And what Allen had noted and observed, even in the short time that he was had seen these blooms occur, was that they happened in a periodicity. For some reason, there was a periodicity to them, about 5 to 10 years. And you can see that here, that they occur for about 5 years, and then they go away, and then they come back. And it's a really interesting fact that we've noted as well. And on the bottom here, you see this is a chlorophyll program that McGowan had set up in 1983. And that chlorophyll program has been collected twice per week. There was a pause in the middle, unfortunately, when funding was lost for that. And what you see is, again, there can be some annual cycle, but there's not always a seasonal, an annual, a peak in the summer. That in, say, like the years 83 and other years, that those aren't there. But you can see these blooms that do occur. And I have a list of the highest blooms that have occurred, except for the 2020 bloom, which was the highest that we've ever recorded and hopefully will be the highest we will ever record. Most of us were not able to go out to the beach, which was a good thing. We weren't really publicizing that it was like the largest bioluminescent bloom that was happening, for the reason because it was happening during COVID. And luckily I was able to be here to sample that and see that. So these are some examples of aerial photos of what water looks like during that red tide. The bottom is from the 2020 bloom. So you see how much more dense and packed it is with Lingulidinium. It was really gross. So what happened was that we ended up having a die-off of fishes and invertebrates and lots of things. Even the aquariums had animals that didn't make it. And that's what led us to think that potentially there was something else there other than the oxygen depletion. Because again, you assume fish can get out of the way. The woman shown here, Eva Ternan, was the chemist that was working. We were working together during this time period. And we were collecting, she was collecting samples, or we both were collecting samples for to study yesotoxin, but she was the one that was putting those together and analyzing them for how much yesotoxin was out there. And what we found is that we were able to detect it, we were able to find it, but it probably wasn't enough to cause harm to the animals. But one thing that was really interesting that we were able to do during this study was also detect it in aerosols. So this is the first time it's ever been detected in the air. So like Karenia brevis, if you, any of you are familiar with the HAB producer on Florida coast where you're not allowed to go to the beach whenever those blooms are occurring, that's an aerosolized toxin that's out there. And so you can have effects, you can have wheezing and other problems. And when these blooms become really dense, we actually get calls from surfers and different people. And those are what we think are the people that are more sensitive, potentially allergic, because not everyone's allergic to it or sensitive to it. However, it can be a problem if you're exposed to it for a long period of time. End of the story is that it seems that the low oxygen here on the bottom right, two other amazing women here at Scripps, Jen Smith and Sam Clements, that keep the SOARS program going, were able to collect the oxygen data that we were able to show and show that during the peak of the bloom, they're starting around the end of April to the 1st of May, that that's really what caused the animals to die, was both the hyperoxygenation and the hypo, so having no oxygen. I'm going to move to a completely different topic and talk about extreme events, being marine heat waves and El Niños, and especially when those are combined, they can be really can be very extreme. In 2014 and lasting through 2018, you can see here in this diagram, the colored diagram in the middle, this is taken from glider data from Dan Rudnick's group, that collects offshore data. This is collected off of line 90. So if you look at the coast of California there, and you see the 90, that's where going along the closest to Scripps possible that you see. This is the data that it collects as it's going up and down, and it's all from 10 meters. So it's organized to 10 meters. And it's just showing how intense this heat wave that occurred starting in late 2014. And blue figure here is showing the long-term shore stations program temperature anomaly along with an index that they have created for El Niños, showing how closely those match. So even though we don't have the highest technology, we still do some amazing stuff just collecting day after day for years and years. So persistence pays. So this is the setup for what was happening. And how the plankton responded, I almost saw it immediately. Within a few months, I was like, where are our plankton? What's going on? There's no plankton in the water. Our chlorophyll, I was wondering if our fluorometer was broken because our fluorometer levels were so low. What you see here in this table is showing all of our monitoring stations that we have in Southern California, and they're listed on the map there. And you'll see the 5-year mean from 2008 to 2013 versus those warm years and what that percent change is. And I've also got that for cell counts as well. So we saw a drastic reduction in the amount and the biomass of plankton. And this didn't just happen at the coast, it also happened throughout the entire Calcafe domain. You can see here the difference between the red year, which is 2014, versus earlier years where it would be more normal, if you might call it that, versus the north and even the south. And this reduction in phytoplankton went down to about 40 meters, which is a lot as far as the depth. And What's interesting, and I threw this in here to give you again a little more perspective about how different our coast can be in what's happening, and maybe why the news about harmful algae is so complicated and maybe difficult to understand, is exactly the opposite thing was happening in the Pacific Northwest. So everything north of the Southern California Bight, I really wish I had a pointer, should have brought one. Anyways, but the Southern California Bight is that area where San Diego, Los Angeles, oh, perfect. See if I can operate this now. No, I can't. Not a big deal. Anyways, you guys know where the Southern California Bight is, San Diego and Los Angeles, the white part down there, where everything north of the in the Pacific Northwest was seeing the exact opposite of us. They weren't having decreased plankton. They were having blooms of pseudonychia, these very large-scale blooms that were causing massive die-offs of whales, sea lions, dolphins, major stranding efforts. And then they even had a closure of the Dungeness crab fishery. It was that bad. So again, just to put it into perspective, things don't happen. They happen on these very small scales with plankton. So to move on to some of the new technologies, I wanted to share with you our most fun toy that we have, which is a peer camera. This was donated to us by Deep Sea. The camera is taking images or taking continuous video feed that can give us some idea about the visibility. And people are also using it to look at different, so they can start to auto-recognize different species and things like that. Kayla put together during one of these blooms, because we see these quite often, where water will intrude. This is over 1 hour, the difference in what you see in the visibility and the amount of plankton and how it arrives. So along our coast. And another cool technology that we have is called the Imaging Flow Cytobot. I thought this thing was for sure going to take my job, but luckily it requires a lot of work and a lot of fine-tuning to make it work, so it might have created actually another job. So good job, robot. But we have 11 stations that are at piers throughout California. And then we also have, and one of those is also a mooring, or two of those are moorings. And then we have one unit that goes out on cruises. And here's a mosaic of the pictures of that it takes. And there's multiple pages of this, but this is just an example. The one that I and my group maintain is deployed in Newport Beach. The one here at Scripps Pier, Kasha and Clarissa, again, just trying to highlight as many awesome women scientists out there. This is the one that they keep running out here on Scripps Pier. And this is images that are taken from three different months, three blooms, and they were blooms, they would qualify for a bloom, and the variety of the organisms that were there. So everything from a dinoflagellate bloom back to a diatom bloom, and then back to almost a single monoculture dinoflagellate bloom. And they are working right now to be able to create automated recognition and automated tools that can show you the HAB species as the samples are coming through every 20 minutes. So it's pretty an amazing feat, and this is just starting. So I want to thank you all for your attention, and be happy to answer some questions. And then I just really want to make sure I note all the funding that we've received over time and that we hope to continue to receive. So if any of you are interested, the QR code up there gets you to our lab website, or you can go the old-fashioned way and look us up. Thank you.
Because we have a glimpse into what both of you focus on, can you talk a little bit about the collaborative process?
Go ahead. Well, I had the pleasure of accompanying Melissa on the pier a little while back. It was amazing, actually twice, because once we went together and then once we went with a filmmaker. And it's an amazing setup. And actually, Alan's time scale is on there, on those walls, right? Those posters. Temperature and salinity, which I was amazed to see also. But just the whole setup, how you look down into the ocean and take the samples that you do every week, right? Or more than a time, almost.
Yeah, so we there's two programs, and it gets really confusing for most people, is that there's a daily temperature salinity time series, and the aquarists are actually the ones that keep that going now. And then there's the weekly and two times per week sampling that we do for harmful algae and for phytoplankton. And so what Alan ended up doing after the 30s was ended up realizing that he would take a little bit, an aliquot of each day sample and put that together to create his week sample. We unfortunately haven't done that. We just collect one day as a representative. But Judith and I started working together through just this program. As someone that, myself, that did active research, I also worked with Jules, helping him to get the that initial plankton camera in the water. He tested it on our gear down at the pier. And then also John McGowan and I helped Jules really determine how to set those cameras up to be able to know. He wanted to just create one. You know, everyone always wants to make it as cheap as possible, but it was necessary for him to have two, one that could focus on the microplankton and one that could focus on the nanoplankton, so like the zooplankton, the larger organisms. And since I was one of the few people that were still around from his lab that could show, or that had worked with Jules and could show Judith the sampling that we do, we got connected that way. And it's been really amazing, and hopefully we'll get to work together on more projects. But I think it was just the subject that brought us our topics together.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.